From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Scott Tong. This is Here and Now. In Iowa today, some 33,000 students in the Des Moines public school system are required to wear masks, as are their teachers. The superintendent brought back the mask rule after a federal judge blocked a state law banning such mandates in school. The law was signed in May by Iowa's Republican Governor Kim Reynolds, but for now that is not in effect. Tom Ahart is superintendent of Des Moines Public Schools. And Tom, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
Good to have you. So you decided very quickly after Monday's ruling to bring back the mask mandate. Why?
The conditions in Polk County, where Des Moines is located in the center of the state, actually in many respects are worse now than they were a year ago at this time. We've had, as recently as the end of last week, over a 15% positivity rate. That has dropped a little bit. We're a little over 13% now.
Wow.
And since the beginning of the school year, we've had over 300 positive student cases, and those are split proportionately among our elementary, middle, and high school level. So we know that the vaccination rate in Polk County is not where it needs to be. And we also know from county records that we have a woefully low percentage of our eligible students vaccinated. So the best tool that we have by far is for everyone to wear a mask.
Now, the governor responded to this court ruling, this temporary blocking of the implementation of the state law by saying this situation now took away parents' ability to decide what is best for their child. She plans to appeal this. You've had mask rules for most of last year in the school district. How much parental pushback have you actually had?
It will be interesting to see what transpires here in the next few days. Last year, I have to say that our community was hugely cooperative. Staff and students alike did an excellent job of staying masked when they were sharing air with others. We have received some pushback already since I made the announcement. And really, the core of it really is this idea that people want the freedom to make the decision that they think is best for their child. And and what I've been trying to emphasize is that we have a freedom to do things up until the point where we infringe upon someone else's right to have freedom from something. And we wear a mask not to protect ourselves. We wear a mask to protect others. And testing is woefully unavailable in our area. Even when folks are able to access a test, there's often a more than a 24-hour turnaround time. And so while we are pushing very hard to have testing more readily available in our schools, that is not a great prevention tool because obviously the virus is already present by the time someone tests positive.
I want to ask you about this appeal the governor has talked about. An appeal would go to the 8th Circuit Court of Appeal that's loaded with judges appointed by Presidents Trump, Bush 43, Bush 41. Is this potentially going to seesaw back and forth politically here?
There is that potential for the seesaw effect. Certainly last year we went through that in spades. And there was uncertainty almost on a day-to-day basis on how school was going to be conducted. So we do want to avoid that sort of whipsaw effect as much as we can. In speaking with legal counsel, we're relatively confident that at least through the end of this calendar year, there won't be time enough for the 8th Circuit to hear an appeal and make a decision. So even if it only buys us, you know, a month or 2 months, that's going to prevent infection in our schools. It's going to enable us to keep schools open and most likely prevent some avoidable deaths.
And finally, as you know, elsewhere in the country, we're seeing some school districts going against states that have these bans on mask mandates. Florida is withholding money from school districts that are going against the state law. Texas is suing some of these districts that are doing the same things. If push comes to shove for your school district, would you go against the state?
I don't think our school board has an appetite for going against the state again. We did that last year, really pushing to remain virtual when our positivity rates were extremely high in Polk County. And we were unsuccessful in fighting the state on that. In fact, I got personally punished by the Board of Educational Examiners. I think we know where the state stands. And by the same token, we know what our goals are and what our mission is. And I'll be pushing as hard as I can and desperately try to stay within the bounds of the law. But it's really important that we do all we can to protect the health and safety of not only our students, but also our staff, and give all of them a fighting chance to have a successful school year, which is historically more important now than ever after the very challenging year that we had last year.
Tom Ahart is superintendent of Des Moines Public Schools in Iowa. Thanks, sir, for the time, and good luck this semester.
Thank you.
Hurricane Nicholas, now a tropical storm, made landfall near Houston this week and took out power to more than 500,000 homes. Millions remain under flood warnings. The storm comes 4 years after Hurricane Harvey wreaked havoc across Texas's infrastructure. And it kind of feels like deja vu. Severe storm after severe storm slamming into the Gulf Coast, devastating cities before they can recover from the latest damage. It's all part of what scientists say is the new normal. Extreme weather disasters made more frequent and severe by climate change. Some officials have promised changes in infrastructure. Here's Sylvester Turner, mayor of Houston, last month.
Hurricane Harvey was a defining moment for Houston, and we are building forward in the right way for a stronger and more resilient city that is prepared to withstand the challenges of the future.
Joining us now is Jim Blackburn, an environmental law professor at Rice University's Baker Institute of Public Policy, and he's been advocating around climate change in Houston for decades. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tanya.
Let's go back to 2017, when flooding from Hurricane Harvey lasted for weeks. And in the end, it was something like more than $120 billion in damages. You wrote a report on flood preparedness after that storm. 4 years later, is Houston better equipped to deal with the flooding threat from this current storm?
Well, I think, one, we were very fortunate with the current storm. It was a baby storm. It really only grazed the Houston region. We did not get near the rainfall that was anticipated. So we were very fortunate. We are better prepared, but we are not well prepared for a big storm. A Harvey-like storm would wreak havoc once again. A coastal surge flood coming in with a big storm, category 5 storm, would devastate the Houston economy and our oil and gas manufacturing base.
You've been sounding the alarm bells about the effects of climate change in Texas for years. As you see it, what is it about Texas's infrastructure that leaves it so vulnerable to flooding?
Well, I think for so long we have just depended upon the past to be an indicator of the future. And these very large severe storms were much rarer in the past than they are now and will be in the future. The climate science is clear that our storms will be more intense going forward. And I'm not sure that has fully translated yet. I'm not sure that our officials that are responsible for floodplain mapping, for land use regulation, for really understanding and setting standards and understanding how to develop with these new flood norms in mind. I'm not sure any of this has penetrated to the extent that it must penetrate for us to be able to survive into and through the 21st century.
Do you think it's also a lack of political will to change infrastructure?
Well, I think the political will has not been in Texas, at least, to admit that the climate was changing until very recently. I think we have been late to come to that recognition, and I think that we will be paying for that, frankly, in the with the consequences of having not thought about it. And these storms are like body blows to the coast. We will see retreat from the coastline, even as we build defenses to try to protect. And we are in the process of building defenses in the Houston region, but it will take another 10 to 20 years to have a really good defensive system. And there could be a lot of damage between now and then.
What immediate infrastructure changes would you recommend to officials right now to better protect Texas as we see these storms coming through and really other urban areas prone to flooding?
I think the most immediate thing we can do is buy out heavily damaged homes and businesses that are in unsafe areas and really can never be made safe, at least not in the near future. Most homeowners that we talk to don't want to be bought out. but they would be willing to be bought out right after they have been flooded. And I think we need to be ready with offers. And I think it is the, I think that is the most opportune time to be helpful to homeowners, is when they have the distress and need the help immediately. Repairs are important, but so is actually removing structures from areas that, frankly, we'll never be able to protect. Much of our development in Houston has been very close to the bayou system, and we need to give more room for the water in this community. And I think that'll be true for most communities in the United States as we come to understand that these new norms will mean a lot more water coming down rivers and streams that did not used to have that much water.
That's Jim Blackburn, an environmental law professor at Rice University's Baker Institute for Public Policy. Jim, thank you so much.
Oh, you bet. Thank you, Tanya.
In California, Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom has easily survived a recall election. His COVID-19 policies and lockdowns were a big issue, and some Democrats say this is now a proven playbook. Republicans live another day and suggest they may have their candidate for next year's gubernatorial race. Let's bring in two longtime California political pros. Rob Stutzman is a Republican strategist. He was on the communications team in 2003 when Arnold Schwarzenegger won a recall race and became governor. Christine Pelosi chairs the Women's Caucus of the California Democratic Party. And yes, she has a famous mom, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Scott.
Okay, I want to ask both of you, and first to you, Rob, if the pandemic was the story here, Gavin Newsom was the first governor to impose stay-at-home lockdowns and require vaccinations for teachers. Larry Elder said he would undo restrictions before breakfast if he, as Republican, became governor. You people wake up early on the West Coast. Rob, your thoughts on the pandemic?
Well, it's one of the great ironies of the way this recall played out is that the pandemic was probably a primary cause that the recall took place. It was the fuel behind the signature collection. But at the end of the day, Gavin Newsom was very much on the popular.
Oh, and I think we have lost Rob temporarily. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Christine, as we try to get Rob back, your thoughts on the pandemic's role in this, this recall?
Well, to finish Rob's thought, which I think I share, and he'll let us know otherwise. At the beginning, people really resented the lockdowns. They resented the shutdowns. They resented the conflicting information as we were learning about the disease and what to do about COVID. And frankly, the initial response hit hardest on some of the Democrats-based communities, Southeast Asians, African Americans, and Latinos. We learned that lesson. And in 2021, by the time the recall was qualified, the vaccine distribution in multiple languages with trusted emissaries was much, much better than the initial communication of and distribution of the mask order and the shutdown order. So ironically, the COVID crisis that got us into the recall also got us out of it because the governor responded with empathy towards the people who were saying, you know, you have to make our lives better. I have a public school child who's in a classroom for the first time in 17 months. I think that for the 6 million children back in public school, those parents, we were very mad at the lockdown, but we also are glad that our children are alive, and we're also glad that they're back in school. So there was a shift in COVID, a shift in the governor's response, and this recall came just at the moment that his belief in science and our belief in engaging our base communities in a grassroots way, both to get their vaccines and to care about this this election, converged to result in victory.
Okay, and we do have Rob back on the line. And just sticking quickly on this issue, is it your sense, Rob, that in the end, a lot of voters came out because of the pandemic policies?
Oh, I think the contrast in the policies between the two candidates, between Newsom and Elder, who became essentially the only other option, absolutely drove particularly Democrat turnout. I think it drove a lot of moderates off of voting yes for the recall or not even voting at all, because it was, you know, it takes a statement direction that they're just not willing to go. They got vaccinated, and they want the state to lean in the vaccinations.
Yeah. Okay, so I want to turn to the potential national implications here. Let's take a quick listen to Gavin Newsom last night.
We said yes to science. We said yes to vaccines. We said yes to ending this pandemic. We said yes to people's right to vote without fear of fake fraud or voter suppression.
Now, Christine, the Newsom team suggests Democrats should run on, outside of California, should run on this next year, notably on vaccines. You think that's a smart playbook or potentially a risk of the Big Brother counterargument?
Well, we start early voting calls into Virginia next week, so it will be a very quick test of the messaging. I do think that that's part of the playbook to say that vaccines and masks work. You can have a shot or you can have a shutdown. It's your choice. But the governor needs to have a statewide mandate because you can't make every janitor, every waitress, every hospital worker be the mask police. That has to come from the state. And that will be critically tested, I think, in Virginia. But the other thing is that candidates need to do what the governor eventually did, which is to really lean into and listen to people who are exhausted and angry and scared about COVID, because COVID is still deadly and people are still in pain, and you have to listen to them first before you just scare them with a partisan message. So as a proud Democrat, a member of the DNC, I'm saying it can't be a partisan message. It has to be an empathic message first.
Okay, and Rob? Proud member of the RNC, your thoughts?
Well, not the RNC these days, but I do. I think the cautionary tale for Republicans here is that in states where you want to be competitive, so in blue states where you want to press Democrats who may be vulnerable in the midterms, in purple states, frankly, the states where there's going to be U.S. Senate races for the balance of power next year, you cannot expect to win if you're going to nominate candidates that fit the caricature of Trumpism. It's a loser. Donald Trump lost the White House, the House, and the U.S. Senate during his tenure as president. Larry Elder last night mimicked him and his positions, and the blue California is going to blow him out by about 30 points. So it's hard because of where the electorate is with Trump. But, you know, people like Mitch McConnell know this. That's why they're trying to mitigate the types of Trump-like candidates that are running in early in some of these primaries that could really pose challenges for Republicans next year.
All right. Now, speaking of Larry Elder, let's take a quick listen to him. He said last night that he lost the battle, but not the war.
But ultimately, I decided to run because I felt that I could do something about the crime. I could do something about the homelessness. I could do something about the fact that California has now hit $800,000 average price of a home. That's 150% above the national average. Outrageous.
So, Rob, staying with you, despite these results, any takeaways from Elder's messaging here to potentially elevate certain issues outside of California?
Well, so Elder correctly identifies issues that are very unsettling to a lot of Californians, regardless of their party perspective. You know, when this race was an abstract question, Gavin Newsom yes knows, when the polling showed it being, you know, only about 5 points. So Elder's correct, but what he doesn't go on to add is that, he, you know, messengers like him that also have positions that are far out of step with the mainstream of a state like California are not the correct messengers. People are not going to have confidence and faith that someone like him could fix it. But if Republicans had more moderate choices to put forward, like a Governor Larry Hogan, who's a Republican governor of a blue state, those types of candidates are what people would be looking for. If at all, they're going to, you're going to expand beyond your Republican base.
Okay, and Christine, let me ask you, where now does Gavin Newsom go from here? I mean, truly, at one point he was politically wounded by those images of him dining at a, I don't know, $300 dinner restaurant with a lobbyist without a mask. Where does he go this next year?
Well, Gavin Newsom has a pile of bills in front of him right now. I saw him and first partner yesterday, and I said to Jen, well, you get your husband back. She said, not yet. We have all those bills to sign, including one that's a Planned Parenthood bill, which obviously Larry Elder would have vetoed. So there's some direct work he has to do right now and just take the same energy, the being humble, grateful, and resolved into 2022. He's got to sign these bills, some on housing, homelessness, and crime reduction, by the way. And also remember, this is also, victory is also made possible because we elected President Biden, Vice President Harris, Speaker Pelosi, and Leader Schumer. We're going to get another round of those Biden child tax credit checks coming up today in people's bank accounts. That helps. So he has to continue making sure that people know that he cares more about our lives and livelihoods than he does his own personal livelihood. And if he does that, then he will be reelected strongly. I bet he is very grateful to the voters today, but also grateful that Larry Elder is staying in the race, because with Larry Elder as his opponent in 2022, Gavin Newsom will win, and we will win back some of those congressional seats we need to hold the majority in 2022.
And Rob, to you on this question, where what do you expect to hear, I guess, from the GOP in Sacramento over the next year?
Well, I think they'll try to regain their focus on the issues where the ruling Democrats are vulnerable, and that is a lack of progress on the homelessness epidemic in California, rising crime at a time when this governor's closed two prisons and is, you know, and proud of that. That's it. That's his agenda. And yet crime, particularly violent crime, is dramatically on the rise. And we have street inflation in California. I think this is the problem for the Democrats nationally, is the increasing price of food, fuel, and the cost of living for most Americans.
Okay, that is Rob Stutzman, political strategist, Republican, and Democrat Christine Pelosi. Thanks to you both for your time.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
There is promising new research for amputees. Patients who have had arms or legs removed tend not to have much control over their artificial limbs. But an experimental new surgery has amputees feeling the presence of their missing fingers and hands, so their brains can help them control prosthetic limbs. The research is being done at Walter Reed National Medical Center in Bethesda, Maryland, outside of D.C., and Brigham and Women's Faulkner Hospital in Boston. Gideon Gill has been reporting on this for our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine publication. Hi, Gideon.
Hi there, Scott. Good to be with you.
Good to have you. Now, you open your piece with an Iraq war veteran who has what's called the phantom hand. Tell us about him.
Yes. So Jerry Majedich was seriously wounded in Iraq in a bombing in 2005 and lived with a lot of pain for 15 years before deciding to undergo this operation last year. After having this new kind of amputation, he's now is able to feel as if his fingers and hand are still there. I opened the piece by writing about a surgeon talking to him and asking him questions. Can you give me a thumbs up? You know, I was there watching this, and it seemed like a weird question to be asking a man without a hand. But in fact, it made perfect sense to Jerry because of the way this procedure is done, mind's eye, he is actually sensing that there's a hand and fingers there.
Wow. And tell me a little bit more about this kind of amputation surgery. It kind of allows or restores this connection between the brain and the muscles?
Yes. So it restores this sense that we call proprioception. And this is the sense you have that allows you to know where your limbs are in space without looking at them because of our sense of proprioception. And that comes about because we have receptors in our muscles that pick up, that send signals to the brain about what the muscles are doing. But that relies on pairs of muscles being connected together. That is what allows for this sense of proprioception to happen. So in a standard amputation, the connections between the muscles are cut and not reconnected. But this new procedure, which was pioneered at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston and also by engineers at MIT, they've learned to reconnect the muscles and reestablish this sense of proprioception.
Wow. This is remarkable, and I have a little of my own experience in this department. I had cancer in two parts of my shoulder back in my 20s, And back then, the miracle of modern medicine was to was having surgery to remove the tumors, save the arm, avoid amputation. Does this suggest the idea of amputation as failure is changing?
Yes, this is really one of the very exciting things that's emerging from this, is that just as plastic surgery has been done for many years to reconstruct limbs, amputation is now being viewed as something that can actually be reconstructive and restore very good function.
Well, that's remarkable. And you end your piece so well with the promise of this patient, perhaps eventually as this technology moves on, to be able to use his prosthetic hand to reach out and hold hands with his wife. Remarkable. Gideon Gill is with our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine Publication. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
Apple has emerged bruised but ultimately victorious from a legal battle accusing it of unfair business practices. A federal judge tossed out last week a claim that Apple is a monopoly. The judge ordered the plaintiff in the case, Fortnite maker Epic Games, to pay Apple $6 million. But Judge Yvonne Gonzalez-Rogers also struck down Apple's policy forbidding developers from selling app subscriptions outside of the App Store. And that could have major implications for the future of many tech and gaming businesses. Ina Fried is a chief technology correspondent for Axios, and she's been following this trial and joins us now. Hi, Ina.
Hi, Tanya.
Let's go back for a moment. Epic's complaint began in August of last year when they defied Apple's developer policies by allowing Fortnite players to purchase in-game items directly from Epic. And Apple then banned Fortnite from iOS and Epic sued. Parse this out for us. What did the judge say in this ruling?
So as you point out, it was mostly positive for Apple. They found that Apple wasn't a monopoly. That was the key to most of Epic's claims. Epic wanted really big relief here. They wanted Apple to be forced to allow rival app stores and rival purchase mechanisms. The judge did find, as you point out, that they violated a California fair business statute, and that related to the prohibition around developers even communicating within the app that there's other ways to buy goods. So there's an impact here, and it's not in isolation. We've seen other nipping at the heels of Apple's policies. So they've gotten to keep the core pillars that they want most badly, but around the edges, they've had to make some changes because of this and other cases.
Right. Epic is not alone. Spotify and the Match Group, owners of Tinder, also praised the Epic decision. We should say Epic is appealing this decision. On what grounds?
Well, you know, Epic's going to argue, I imagine, the judge was wrong on the law, wrong on the facts, you know, all the things one argues on appeal, that the way that she defined the market was erroneous. So a lot of this case hinged on how you define the market, because that tells you whether Apple has a monopoly. So Apple certainly has a monopoly over its own ecosystem, but that's not the way that monopolies are usually defined. So there was a lot of debate during the trial, and this came up in the ruling of what is the relevant market. In the end, the judge chose a different market than either Apple or Epic presented at trial, but again, found that Apple was not a monopoly.
You know, Ina, of course, Apple is famous for its gadgets. It still makes most of its money from selling computers and phones. But just how important has the App Store become to its business?
I mean, it's huge in a variety of ways. One is just the absolute dollars. We're talking about billions of dollars by any account. The other is it gives them a hold. Once you've spent a fortune on apps, particularly if you spend it directly with Apple, you're less likely to move to another device, and that can't be overlooked. And then the third thing I would say is that this is very profitable revenue, and this came up at the trial, is just how big are Apple's margins. But suffice to say, they're big. So Apple isn't just losing revenue when it loses a dollar of App Store revenue. It's losing, you know, pick a number, 70, 80 cents of profit on every dollar of its App Store revenue.
The lawsuit was against Apple, but what does this mean for others like Google, which runs the other big marketplace for mobile apps, which is the Google Play Store?
Yeah, I mean, Epic's battle here was really a two-front battle. It did the exact same thing on Google the same day. The facts are a little bit different. So on the Google side of things, apps can be sideloaded onto Android, whereas that's not an option on the Apple side. But essentially, their case is similar against Google. It hasn't gone to trial yet, so it's less far along. But they were filed the same day, and Epic provoked Google in the same way it provoked Apple by updating the app to include something that was explicitly forbidden in anticipation of challenging it in court.
There's so much to follow here, including what it means for app developers. That's Ina Free, Chief Technology Correspondent for Axios. As always, thank you so much.
Always good to talk, Tanya.
And we want to take a few minutes to remember music impresario George Ween, who died Monday at the age of 95. He co-founded the Newport Jazz and Folk Festivals. Newport was the first and largest event of its kind in the U.S., setting the standard for outdoor music festivals to come. NPR's Walter Ray Watson reports Ween was a musician himself and a true fan.
George Ween lived a life most jazz fans dream about. He knew the giants and innovators by their first names. At the very first Newport Jazz Festival in 1954, Ween arranged a reunion between saxophonist Lester Young and singer Billie Holiday. The two former collaborators hadn't spoken for years. He told a private Newport audience in 2003 that Young hesitated in the wings.
This is one of the most poignant memories of my life, because there was this magnificent saxophonist, one of the great figures in the history of the music, standing there and wasn't going on the stage, and Billie sang about three choruses of her first song. And the next thing you know, he says, I hear him saying, I guess I'll have to go up and help the lady out.
The reunion was never recorded, but the festival next year was. Ween booked Miles Davis to play at a time when the trumpeter was on the ropes. The performance jump-started Davis's career. But NPR contributor and former New York Times jazz critic Nate Chenin says Ween's goal was much bigger than lending a hand to individual artists.
I know that he was especially passionate early on about winning a kind of respect for jazz in sort of mainstream culture.
Chenin co-wrote Ween's memoir, Myself, among others. He says Ween was proud of having a hand in making jazz the accepted American art form it is now. But Ween's relationship to the artists was just as important.
He understood the musician mindset, and he really, really cared about how musicians were doing, you know, and wanted to support them both as, you know, a promoter and producer, and also just as a friend to the music.
Because he was a musician, a child prodigy, and in his teens, he played jazz piano professionally around Boston. As an adult, he managed Storyville, one of the city's clubs, and took notice of the folk music revival embraced by Boston College students in the 1950s. He booked the likes of Odetta and Josh White into his club, and the reception they got convinced him to launch a festival.
As I remember it, it was a pretty big deal for me.
Singer Joan Baez had a steady coffee shop presence around Harvard Square. But, she says, Newport was something else.
I don't think there had been a place where there was one tent full of, say, Shaker white singers, and the next tent full of black blind blues singers from Mississippi, you know, and they began taking it for granted that they were all making music.
And Newport made history. Joan Baez introduced a young Bob Dylan in 1963 to his largest national audience at the time. And just 2 years later, Dylan broke with folk purists and went electric at Newport. Newport's popularity led Ween to start a production company. He took his approach to New Orleans, where he boosted the city's Jazz and Heritage Festival and eventually exported his concept around the world. In 2007, Ween sold his company and tried to enjoy semi-retirement. But 2 years later, the festivals he founded had gone bankrupt. And at the age of 82, Ween set up a nonprofit foundation to protect Newport's future, as he told NPR in 2011.
The only chance we have of keeping the festival alive after I'm gone is to have a foundation and people that want to keep it alive.
Speaking on the occasion of Newport's 50th anniversary, George Wein told the public radio show American Roots there was a very basic reason for his success.
My real talent was making things happen.
And he did, for more than half a century, for fans and musicians alike. Walter Ray Watson, NPR News.
Grapes are in season in many parts of the country. And here in Now, resident chef Kathy Guntz has been coming up with both savory and sweet uses for them. And she joins us now. Welcome back, Kathy.
Hello, Tanya.
Grapes are great snacks all by themselves. The kids in this house love them. They have a battle over red versus green. But you've been experimenting with roasting them. What does that do for the flavor?
Well, it's really interesting because when you roast grapes, so you can keep them on the vine or have them loose, sprinkle them with a little olive oil, put them in a 400-degree oven, and you roast them for just 15 minutes till they almost burst and the flavors intensify. And roast grapes, just as they are so beautiful to serve with cheese plates, on top of salads, with roast chicken. Really interesting the way a very simple technique transforms them and brings out this very grapey, depthful flavor.
You also use roasted grapes in a salad.
I did. So I took a buttery lettuce, something like really a soft lettuce, and I roasted red and green seedless grapes, put them in the middle of the lettuce, scattered it with feta cheese, almonds, you could use pistachios, walnuts, and raw celery. And then the vinaigrette is quite simple. It's made from the juices that you roasted the grapes in with a little bit of wine vinegar. So this salad comes together in about 10 minutes.
Sounds good. I mean, you also have this recipe that uses grapes and bacon. How did you come up with this combination?
Yeah, I mean, I don't quite know, but I thought when you sometimes grapes almost taste meaty. They're tart, they're sour, they're also a little bit sweet. So I made a flatbread, which is not a pizza and it's not focaccia. It's a very simple dough. You mix flour, yeast, a little salt and sugar. It rises for an hour and a half. And if you're thinking, no way, I'm not doing that, who's got time? Go buy some pre-made pizza dough and you lay it out into a circle or a rectangle, and that is your flatbread base. And then I added red and green grapes, some cooked crumbled bacon, grated Parmesan cheese, and a little goat cheese. And you bake it and the grapes soften, but they still have that tart snap. And then you sprinkle it with parsley and olive oil, and it's a wonderful... It's wonderful to drink with a glass of wine, but we had a whole lunch and dinner out of it. Just so flavorful. And if you're a vegetarian, you could add caramelized onions instead of bacon to get that kind of smoky, meaty flavor.
You're really setting a scene here. Like, you're giving us all dinner plans for tonight.
Good. I hope so.
Yeah, right? Right? Those are two savory recipes, but you also have a recipe for grape jelly. And full disclosure, you sent us some of this. It's like almost gone, Kathy.
Oh,
how
I
difficult
love it.
Was it to make?
It's not difficult, except the way that I did it is that there are a lot of wild grapes near me. So I went out, and foraging for me is a deep pleasure. This time of year, to go out and pick grapes off the vine, they're just dripping with fruit. And I brought them home, and I rinsed them, put them in a pot with a little bit of water, brought it to a boil, and then I mashed them with a potato masher. And then I strained it through some cheesecloth, and I got this gorgeous purple juice. And then you boil down the juice. And I don't like to add a lot of sugar. A lot of jellies, for me, are overly sweet. And I want to taste the nuance of the grape. So I boiled it with just about a cup of sugar, little bit of lemon juice. Depending on what type of grapes you use, you may or may not need liquid pectin, which is a natural thickener. And this jelly, if it's not in your house, will keep for a month, or you can can it and keep it for a year. And I am in love with this jelly. And boy, a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. It never tasted so good, but you can also serve it as a condiment with cheeses.
Yeah, I'm in love with it too. Thank you so much for this recipe. One last thing I just have under a minute with you, but of course we can do PB&Js, but what other uses are you using this jelly for?
Boy, I had a cheese platter with about 3 different cheeses, and the grape jelly just paired so well with like a tart, soft, creamy goat cheese or a very mild cheddar. It goes with all kinds of things. I also would use it to deglaze a skillet if I were sauteing or fish, just for that sweet, tart purple color. Gorgeous.
Yeah. Gorgeous. As always, this is so great to talk with you and get these recipes. We've been talking about some great recipes with Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunston. For all of her recipes, go to hereandnow.org. Kathy, thank you as always.
Thank you, Tanya.
And grapes and cheese, that's like a wonderful combination. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Scott Tong. It's Here and Now.